Tonight on Arena, Pat McCabe brings us into the 1950s border counties in his play Little White Lies, and Colin Greenwood of Radiohead on taking photographs while playing bass. It's now more than three decades since five friends, also known as Radiohead, first played and rehearsed a lot in local village halls in rural Oxfordshire before going on to become one of Britain's biggest bands. Their bassist, Colin Greenwood, began to bring his camera on tour in 2003 after the success of albums like OK Computer and Kid A had sent them into the stratosphere, bringing them to worldwide recognition. How to Disappear is a new book of photos spanning 13 years in the life of the band, and it includes several pieces of text by Greenwood, who is currently on tour with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Delighted that Colin Greenwood joins me on the line on Arena this evening. You're very welcome to the programme, Colin. Delighted that you can be with us.
Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, listen, little did I know that in between your bass guitar playing and everything that you've been doing with Radiohead, you were noodling away with a camera in the background. When did photography become a thing in your life?
It's always been a thing in my life because one of my oldest and dearest friends who used to play in Radiohead when we were all at school, she worked at the Victoria and Albert Museum after college, and I used to go and have a look at the collection. And so it's always been a big love of mine. But I think that the main thing I realised since putting this book out, what happened that caused the book to happen, was that we had our own recording studio. We built it in, was it 2001 or something? And really, that's when the photographs started to, you know, to flow, really, from around 2003 when we started working there. So it was really the fact that we had like a space that we were all, you know, staying in rather than constantly moving around from studios and touring.
That's interesting that it was actually almost that resident space that you guys have, your own studio, that allowed that type of thing. Because it did strike me, you know, we see it all the time in today's world, people going around with their phones, and if you turn sideways, oh, no, wait till I get a picture of that, or wait till I get a video of that. You must have been in the rehearsal room. How secretive a snapper were you? Or did you say to the lads, can I get a picture of that? Or what? How did you handle that side of things?
Oh, can you just play that riff again, and then I'll make sure I get it this time on Phil.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, that didn't really happen very much at all, really. I didn't take pictures whilst we were working on stuff and playing, because I was working on stuff and playing, I suppose. And so the few photographs that I did have of that are in the book. But it was a very unique, privileged point of view to document, you know, the development of the songs and the writing that we did, to take those songs from that little place in southern Oxfordshire all the way to those massive stages around the world.
Now, I'm not surprised either that it is old style analog camera that you have, that you're shooting on film, black and white, a lot of the ones certainly that we get in the book. I suppose this is the visual version of vinyl, isn't it?
Yes, and it's also because I was learning how to use the camera and also print. And like, I've got a little dark room at home, and when you learn like how to make pictures with analog film, you know, you're always told don't start processing film with color because it's complicated. Start with black and white. So that's why most of them are in black and white. And then the other thing, of course, is funny, I think, is I don't know if this is a controversial opinion I'd like to share with you, but I think, like, as you get older, I think black and white could be more forgiving.
I will leave that to the listeners to decide whether that is a controversial opinion or not. But what I did see within the book, you have these wonderful essays within the book as well, Colin.
Yes, thank you.
There are a couple of things that struck me, and I think it's in the first set of essays, in fact.
Yes.
Where you talk about the joy and doubt, the confidence and the uncertainty that you oscillated between. This is in your middle years. This is when Radiohead were huge in all of our minds.
Yes.
And yet you're telling me you were kind of, there were moments of, oh God, are we any good? Is that the type of thing you were asking?
Yes. Well, because every time you make something else, it's held up against what you've done before. You don't know what direction it's going to take you in the future. I mean, that's what being creative is about, I suppose. And it's just an honest admission of that uncertainty, and go, all right, let's do like a bossa nova version of Creep or something, or, you know, let's reinvent the wheel for the millionth time. And when you make a record, it's really not like you're booking your tickets for your next like travel excursion. You know, it's about, you know, when we make records, it's like, we don't know where it's going to take us next. It's an uncertain destination. You know, a lot of this was raised by, Nick, who I'm touring with, Nick Cave, who I'm touring with at the moment. He was the one who said, well, why don't you write about, you know, start off with that idea, bless him. And I think it was a really good jumping off point.
Yeah, because you do make comparisons along the way with the whole act of photography, not least of which is that one I've just mentioned, the analog film and, you know, the vinyl in the studio. And while we start in 2003, within the essays as well, you reminisce about the early days. I love the fact that Radiohead spent their time rehearsing in halls in Oxfordshire and never letting anybody in to see them. You still have that kind of private feel off you.
Well, we did hide our light under a bushel for a very long time, it's true. And the village halls of Oxfordshire definitely profited from our shyness and reticence to ever be in front of the public. It's quite stunning, really, that we went from that sort of self-imposed practice purder to, you know, doing all this touring and stuff and having all this recognition.
Let us go back in time with a little bit of music, if you don't mind. Can we go back to the second album, to The Bends, 1995 or thereabouts, and this track? Just a little bit of Just from The Bends, the 1995 Radiohead album. And with me on the programme this evening, Colin Greenwood, who has just published a book of photographs about the middle years, a little bit after the song we've just heard of Radiohead. But within the book as well, he goes through several essays, great memories of the band's time. When you listen now, Colin, back, I'd love you if you were sitting opposite me to see your face as you listen, because it always tells us a story. What do you feel when you hear Just?
When I hear that song, what an amazing, I love that record, The Bends. I think it's one of my favourite records that we made, and it's kind of its time, but equally it's got sort of chromatic quirks to it that, like, you know, would only be like in a song that we'd have done. So I think that's what I love about it, really.
What I love about the photographs in How to Disappear is they really are things that we never see. You know, it's things like Johnny Greenwood sitting on a chair, noodling on the guitar, doing something.
Or yes.
Your brother at the guitar, he gets a lot of photographs, let's be honest.
Oh, yes.
And Tom York, obviously noodling as well. But I'm looking at one on page 66, and I'm just wondering about it, because obviously you're the photographer here, and that means you're not in the photographs. But on page 66, we have somebody taking a photograph of Tom York. Is that you taking the, I can't quite make out because it's in profile.
What? There's a photograph of Tom?
Yeah, it's the snapshot, the one in the book is a photograph of somebody else taking a photograph of Tom York.
Oh, yeah,
now,
that's right.
Who's taking the photograph?
Well, that photograph was taken at the Landmark Hotel in Marylebone Road in London, where I was like a few nights ago, when I flew from Budapest with Nick Cave just to come and go to the opening launch of the book. So I was there two nights ago, freakily enough. And that's where we did our press and promo for Hail to the Thief. And it's my friend Jason, who's an amazing photographer, Jason Evans. Anyway, he's photographing Tom, and I'm photographing him photographing Tom. And it's just one of those sort of meta pictures, I suppose.
Because I was wondering, how did you manage somehow? Did somebody else get the camera off you to get a picture of you taking a picture?
We'd have slipped down some kind of vortex of like time. But it was a hotel. So you two used to stay back in the day, apparently.
All right.
And it was just like this sort of place that record companies would put you up for promo, basically. And yeah, it was just like, you know, it was an opportunity to take a picture of, you know, Jason bending down like that, you know, and I really enjoyed it. And all, yeah, it's a happy moment. And I was there to capture it, like you said.
And that's what so many of the photographs have. The, you know, they're you guys backstage are on a tour bus or maybe on an airplane. And well, when I say it's your friends, because you're always taking the photograph, you have managed to disappear. And I presume you were referring to How to Disappear Completely.
Yes.
Yeah, that was the song you were referring to in choosing that title from the book.
Well, yes.
But I'm wondering about another photograph that I'm looking. I'm just going to pick a second one, which is on page 124 of the book.
Yes.
And this, I'm reckoning, is your brother, of course. But it's clearly on stage. There's wonderful lighting around it, which if you tried to set it up in a studio, you'd never get.
Yeah, you couldn't. That's right.
But what were you doing? Why weren't you playing the bass?
I've been busted. Yeah. I've been hoisted by my own photographic petard, haven't I? I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed. I'm mortified. What can I say in my defense? Oh, no. It's like, what happened was, you know, there are some songs where I'm not playing all the time. So, you know, like, because some of our arrangements are kind of like that. So they gives me the moment to sort of grab a camera in front of 30,000 people and scamper about and take pictures. And I actually got some of the most unselfconscious, freest pictures of my band members because they couldn't worry about like me with a camera because they're too busy worrying about playing the right next note, you know. So
At one point you captured, I'm sure he was delighted when you arrived into the bathroom. And I know you've several of Johnny in bathrooms. He seems to have been caught
That's
there several
right.
times.
I'm following my brother in and out of bathrooms in arenas around the world. It's very, very wrong. And I'm sure I'll be cancelled.
But Ed, there's another one of Ed O'Brien, I think, in America around 2008, standing in front of a sink and a mirror. Did they never turn around to you and say, Colin, put down the camera and get lost, please?
No, they're too English. Of course, they're not good. They'll just tut and sigh and go, oh, like that or something. Or just look a bit sort of tense and stressed. So I would leave them be. And, you know, so yes, they've been very, very, very patient and kind and tolerant of my nonsense.
You boss Johnny around, I'm guessing, quite a
I
bit.
I boss him around.
However, he did have the guitar and you have the bass. So maybe that was the kind of payback that he got on you. And you're picking up the bass was...
I got it, Sean.
It's accidental, isn't it?
I got him in the band when he was like, I don't know, 13 or something, 12, 13. So he owes me.
Yeah, and he plays guitar. Well, he plays several instruments, of course. But you are playing bass guitar in the band. You were this very serious young man, I think, playing classical guitar, but you had to throw all that to the one side and pick up the bass guitar.
Yes.
How slow a falling in love was that relationship?
Oh, that's a good question to do with the music about it. Well, I had a little Toshiba receiver and I had cassettes of like, you know, Otis Redding and Booker T and the MGs. And I just fell in love with soul music. And of course, a lot of heart and soul of soul music, as well as the voices, the bass and the rhythm of that and the melody and the counterpoint. And it's like, you know, I'm on tour right now with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And the sound guy who's amazing called Barak, he says for him, when he sets the sound up, it's the voice and the bass. They're right in the middle and everything else is around that. So it's just like, you know, I love that. I love how the bass is like the glue between like the melody and the rhythm as well. It's like sort of central to how that magic is conjured up on stage and how all those sounds, you hope, and colours coalesce, you know. So I'm absolutely thrilled that they made me play bass guitar.
Well, listen, I know, as you say, you're on tour with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds at the moment.
Yes.
How much are you enjoying that? And what? Because when you know, you've been Radiohead rumours that there might be something going to happen again soon. I don't know if you can confirm or deny any of that, first of all.
Well, I can't confirm or deny anything about Radiohead right now, other than that we got together in the summer, as I'm sure you know, and we just all sort of and played. We played about a lot of the songs and stuff. And it was really fun and it was great, you know, because everybody's doing so many different things right now. So, but, you know, it went really well. And I'm sure, you know, that, you know, I'm sure everyone would love to find a way to, you know, make it work for us to do something together again. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, because I know that picture, I should have said it at the time that I was talking about Johnny on stage was actually taken. It was actually taken in Dublin, according to the index back around, I think, 2017, 2018 was the period there. So I know there'll be a lot of people be very happy if we heard there was something happening. However, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds.
Nick Cave.
What does that bring? What has touring with him now brought to you? Because your life in music is a constantly growing and organic thing, it sounds, Colin.
Yes. Well, I play these shows with piano and bass with Nick in America and Europe. And that was really, really fun. And I'm having the time of my life with them. And we're doing this like big European tour, playing like to like tens of thousands of people in arenas across Scandinavia, Eastern Europe. And it's just extraordinary, the experience. And it takes me right back to, I don't think I ever toured this much around here with Radiohead, and it just having the best time. They are the loveliest bunch of people. I cannot praise them highly enough. So, you know, Warren Ellis, of course.
Yes.
He's very much, I mean, if I can make this crass comparison, and I hope everyone will forgive me, but he, in many ways, he's the Johnny Greenwood of the Bad Seeds, in that he's like a sort of multi-instrumentalist, you know, musical director. And he's also like endlessly photographable. I can't say the word, but I mean, you know, I could just do a book. If I was to do a book about this tour, it would just end up lots of pictures of Warren, basically.
Well, there you go.
There you go. But they are the loveliest people, and it's brilliant. And I'm having the time of my life.
I want to finish up with Nude, if I can.
Yes, sir.
Colin, for obvious reasons, I think this song was sitting in the background for a long, long time until Colin Greenwood suggested, what about a new little bass line? What happened? What happened that made this song suddenly come into what it is now?
Well, what happened was really, I came up with a bass line that Tom was really into, I guess. And then before we had a massive Hammond organ, which was amazing. My brother played this massive Hammond sort of part. And then I just said, well, there's a song called How Can You Mend a Broken Heart by the Bee Gees that I think Al Green covers. And halfway through the song, he tips it into a whole other emotional whirlwind by going into falsetto. And so I just said, well, that could be amazing. And Tom has this beautiful falsetto. And it's really, it's one of my favorite songs, and I'm very proud of it. And Tom wrote it, and it's just very magical. And thank you for asking.
Colin, it has been an absolute joy to speak with you on Arena.
You too.
Thanks so much. Enjoy the rest of the tour with Warren and Nick and the lads.
And
hope to see you somewhere with your other four pals from Oxfordshire in the next while. Thanks, Colin Green, very much for being
with us.
Thank you,
Sean.
And we'll finish with Nude. There you go. It had been hanging around for quite a while, since for about 10 years, in fact. I think they first wanted to put it on their OK Computer album, but it didn't get there until Colin Greenwood came up with that very lovely bass line that you heard there in that version of Nude from the In Rainbows album, seventh studio album of Radiohead in 2007. Colin Greenwood was talking to us about his book How to Disappear, a photographic portrait of Radiohead, which is published by John Murray. He will be signing books at Eason on O'Connell Street in Dublin, midday on Wednesday the 13th of November. The signing is advance ticket only. You'll find details if you search online for Eason Presents Colin Greenwood, and he will be playing live on the 12th and 13th of November with Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds at the Three Arena. Anyone who has read The Butcher Boy will know that border towns and the goings on there are a creative well for author Patrick McKay. Pat has written a new play, which he will himself direct at the Garage Theatre in Monaghan. Little White Lies is set in the fictional town of Cullymore in 1958, a few years before the events of The Butcher Boy. The new play feeds into historical events of the time, the IRA border campaign, the space race when the Soviets launched their first dog into space, and the tragedy of the Munich air disaster when 8 members of the Manchester United team died in a plane crash. Delighted that Pat McCabe joins us on the programme this evening. Cullymore sounds, well, maybe because I'm from the same neck of the woods, obviously, Pat. Cullymore sounds like a familiar type of border town, but this 1950s period brings it to life in a really interesting way.
Well, I hope so, Sean. We'll see. But it's not a realistic play in that sense. It's it's more of a dream play, because I suppose when you get to my age, in early 70 now, you know, you kind of, we have moved into an entirely different age, you know, and old quarrels across the globe have reasserted themselves with a tedious predictability. And you go back to 1958 and you examine, I suppose, a kind of sort of an X-ray of the world in which you, when you first came of age, you know, in 1958, when I was a boy, people routinely sang Sean South of Garry On, and they stood for the national anthem after the pictures, and they really believed that Ireland was going to be united. And in 1958, which was the year of the Munich disaster, people really believed that Manchester United were completely and incontestably invincible, protected almost by divine providence. And in 1958, people had no problem at all weeping along with Johnny Ray when he said his heart was broken and tears came coursing down his cheeks. And I suppose in one way you could say that was a more innocent age, but I don't look at it that way. It's kind of a different age, you know. It's not a secular, rational age. It was a place where people didn't see time as an arrow, more like a candle burning down. And when I came to Costello with this script, it was a much bigger script than it is now. It had a number of different styles in it. Because of Johnny Ray and the melodramas and the movies and the fit-ups of that time, I conceived it as big acting, you know, big acting for big ideas. And as it grew, then there was a fusion of styles. It became, as it declared itself at the... When you say I directed it, I didn't really. It's an ensemble direction. Eileen and myself directed in a sense, but ultimately it was one of those glorious opportunities where everybody directed. It's almost like Murder on the Orient Express, without spoiling it for everybody. Everybody did it.
Yeah.
But that, you know, in a way, it kind of mimics the world that I'm speaking about, because there was something about these small places where people instinctively knew how to work collectively. Now it seems to me, when people do that, they do it a little bit more self-consciously. They're not aware of that. But there was something about when you went to the movies, everybody was there. When you went to church, everybody was there. When the Munich air crash happened, everybody felt it. It was a collective seismic shock to the entire community, not just in Monaghan, but in everywhere. But as it kind of declared itself, it became like, there was a book written once upon a time called Mysteries of Pittsburgh. And this became like a Mysteries of Monaghan thing. And the more the actors like Joanne Brennan invented this character, she kind of reinvented it in a way. I had it Like in the Old Testament, God says to Ezekiel, can these old bones live? And that's really what was happening, that these people that are now long gone to the eternal reward began to live again. But she reinvented this character, Mr. Bones, as a diabolic dervish dancer who arrives into the barber shop. In the first scene, just to give you a flavour of it, she sits there in this extraordinary costume, which is kind of a mixture of Hammer House of Horror and Regency Book. And she says here a man was shot, levying war upon the border. And Patsy, who was Colin Carty, Matt Carty's brother, if you don't mind, replies, maybe not. Maybe you should think about getting your hair cut someplace else, eh?
and that setting of the barbershop, it's a great place to kind of, because you can meet the entire community there. They're in and out of the place, and perhaps people will speak in a barbershop with it, not necessarily confessional mode, but they might be a little bit more open to letting things out that they wouldn't be able to let out elsewhere.
It's certainly more open when you blow the roof and the walls off it as well. And I don't mean with a bomb, I mean metaphysically and spiritually, because I asked Fiona Keenan O'Brien, would you be able to create the subconscious of a town for me in a dance that lasts 1 minute? And it's one of those beautiful moments in theatre when you can't believe what you're seeing, because I wasn't even sure what I was asking her for. I said, look, it's a mystery. It's a church, a sacerdotal. You know, the church is very big in this. You know, I think that it's a great shame that people are not analysing the imagistic inheritance of Catholicism. People are so busy poring over these unfortunate tragedies and mistakes that people made that, you know, certainly for me, the first visit to a church with stained glass and the liturgical incantations, which are a constant refrain throughout this play, you know, the church for me was always a place where all the possibilities and impossibilities of human creation were on offer. So from the start, I wanted that kind of pulse beat and rhythmic, because this, again, was part of the cohesive glue that binds communities like that together, in the subconscious as well as the foreground, you know. And I wanted that kind of beat, that kind of constant hum. You know, it's like small talk. It binds people together without them knowing it.
Yeah, and as you talk about that sense of community that is there, even in the fact that there's a priest in this, a Father Frank, who's a kind of a golden boy as far as his mother's concerned. We all think the whole town thinks he's heading to become a Monsignor. The play brings him to other places, and as the darker side of the period possibly unfolds. But that idea of the pageant, he's organising a pageant where the whole community will be out on the street involved in this. That kind of entire town being involved in something in that fashion, that's unusual nowadays, I think.
Well, it's impossible now. It just wouldn't be the same. But that serves a double purpose, you know, because the pageant and those kind of jubilee commemorations and all, they had a particular style of acting. So I wanted it to be a parody of the thing and the thing itself, in the same way that David Lynch sometimes does. You're not quite sure which reality you're in, but hopefully it all ties up together. You're watching a huge big acting style, like Johnny Ray with a huge melodramatic style. And, of course, in those years, Andy McMaster and the Fit-Ups, there were the vernacular that most people were familiar with it. So big grand gestures and, you know, murders on stage and huge big surges of music, all those things came together in this play, but also a kind of domestic Harold Pinter style.
Yeah, because there is another aspect that you have within the play where particularly in the character of Mary, isn't it? Mary is the wife of the butcher,
the barber,
I beg your pardon.
She's played by Krista Rusher Hamilton. And
she's wonderful singer and wonderful Catholic singer, but boy, does she have it in for her Protestant neighbour. There's huge enmity between them.
Well, you see, that's the subtext of the whole border campaign. You know, you have to remember in 1958 that the state was only 30 years old. So people were constantly kind of agonizing, is this going to survive? You were living in a constant state of agitation and worry without manifesting it perhaps publicly. But there was a sense that you cross the border, it's pretty much an armed camp there, you know, and you have the South, which has been regarded by Churchill and these people like a cabbage patch republic. So there was a terrible uncertainty and anxiety, you know, that I wanted to, that's where the Pinter element comes in, you know, menace and dread and uncertainty mixed in with these huge declarations of freedom and indefeasible sovereignty and all the rest of it. But at the heart of it, a sadness, really, and a nervousness.
And there's another aspect of that divide, if you like, as well. I'm thinking of Teddy, who's the younger. I think he's the youngest character, probably in the piece, and his uncle.
He's played by Conal Sheeran. He's McClonus, actually. Yeah.
And the uncle had been a Republican activist, linked in with the border campaign and Sean South and Fergal O'Hanlon, who was the local Monaghan hero, in those terms. But he has this relationship with the doctrinaire Teddy, the young character, with the doctrinaire Republican uncle, but yet he loves the popular culture of England and Britain. Instinctively, he wants to be part of that and feels right about it. But he has a sense of that's kind of pulling him apart. He feels almost disloyal.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's 17, and do 17-year-olds ever know what they really want? You know, he may be able to articulate, you know, that he wants to be part of the London pop culture, but I mean, he's actually heartbroken over his uncle, so he's nervous.
Yeah.
And again, he's got basically what this is the subconscious, an X-ray of the subconscious of a small community, which hopefully could be anywhere, but particularly is in Monaghan, and that's why I'd like. You know, it's a local show, really. It's only on for 3 nights, so I'd really like to get everybody in the theatre and have a look at it and maybe talk about it because, you know, I cast my mind back to that period and there have been so many changes and yet no changes at all in a peculiar way.
Yeah, because it did strike me, that anxiety around you. We hear about the dog, Laika the dog, up in space and that she might be heading off, you know, in the tin can to wander forever. The anxiety around space travel, the anxiety around the Cold War, the anxiety around, you know, the possibility that there would be a nuclear explosion at any moment in time and we'd all be gone. You talked about, when you were writing this, at the very beginning of our chat, you made comparisons, I think, to today's anxieties. Do you see big parallels there?
Well, I think the difference really is, you know, when I spoke about Sean South there and Johnny Ray and all that kind of thing, people collectively felt, as they raised their eyes up to heaven, that there was somebody looking out for them. You know, for better or worse, when you entered the church, you were looking up towards a presence mirrored in the stained glass, the crucifix and all that kind of thing, in the same way that the priest and the doctor were available to you at every time for better or worse. Now you can't say that post-pandemic. You don't know, is there anyone looking after you? Do you want anyone looking after you? It's actually a lonelier place in a way, I find.
Yeah, and that's not to sugarcoat, because definitely, and I don't want to get into the plot of it, but later on you certainly bring us to much darker places in terms of the play is called Little White Lies, you know.
Yeah, so you know, ultimately it's a cautionary tale. I suppose if you were being flippant for the purposes of publicity, you would probably say it's Rosemary's Baby on the Border.
That would probably do quite a good as a good poster piece. You said, Pat, too, about the piece declaring itself to you.
Yeah.
I remember hearing, and I can't remember, I was trying to remember today the specifics of who it was, but a writer speaking about hearing you, and I hope this is not a spoiler alert to people who haven't read The Butcher Boy, that Francie Brady kills Mrs. Nugent, that moment, it was as big a shock to you as it was to all of us who read it in the book. In the writing of it, was it different with this piece where you're talking about a play? You talked about it declaring itself. Did it declare itself on
no,
the page?
No, it's even more exciting actually, because we've cast what nine is it, and as we worked through it, there were not that many problems. One or two writing problems where I had a bit of a problem kind of merging the different realities. But then there were a couple of things when it started to gain momentum where the actors really had kind of wrestled the parts to the ground and were really having fun with them. And there was a lovely moment when the character played by Krista, who is Mary, leaps alive, particularly in the style that I had been hoping would declare itself, but couldn't do it until everything else was in place. That it's a weird mixture. You see, the women in this are very interesting because there's a lot of talk about powerful women and everything now. And all, of course, that's very good. But these women are powerful in the 60s, 50s kind of way. You know that every Easter or so on, there would be a dinner dance. And when the women didn't have that much of a chance to be glamorous in the 60s, particularly from the working class background that I'm talking about, small town working class basically is the core of it. But when they dressed and they really went for it. So one night of the year, or maybe even a couple, the whole town would become like a Douglas Sirk movie or Vertigo. And it was very, very glamorous when these dinner dances or little hunt balls or whatever they were. Certainly, to the growing boy in the adult, to see, as Hugh Leonard memorably said, when the local postmistress becomes Sonia the Minx from Minsk. No, that's not what I'm after here. It's more like Kim Novak,
yeah,
played by Ashley McCormick. It's a particular kind of golden Technicolor, Hitchcock's stroke Douglas Sirk glamour, really.
From what you're saying, Pat, and I know you're not shying, you're not saying, oh, the 90s, all was great in the 1950s, and why
no,
can't we?
No,
I know you're not saying that, but we do get this sense often when people talk about that period in time that it's about suppression, it's about being confined, it's about being held back. This, somehow, the way you're speaking about it this evening, it strikes me as if it's a liberating force in your creative imagination.
Well, put it this way, I'm a great fan of Hilary Mantel's, and she's written a lot about writing people in the past, you know, and she said, we often make a mistake from the alpine peaks of our privilege, you know, and prosperity, of looking down on the people of the past as if it were a rehearsal. It isn't a rehearsal, and they're not our employees. You must place them in the ethical framework of their period. They are our grandparents. And a little bit of humility, I think, sometimes might be called for when we're actually smugly delineating their interior lives and, indeed, their public lives.
Should finish by saying, Pat, there's a lot of there is a great spiritual core in the body of the play, from what I've read of it, but there's a lot of music involved as well.
Yeah.
That's always been hugely important to you, I think, in terms of theatre.
Yeah, I think people should read, if for no other reason, not for any of my words, but if they come along to hear Ashley McCormick singing Ruby Murray's Mr. Wonderful, they won't go away shortchanged.
There you go. Pat, great to speak with you, and hope it all goes well at the run in the garage.
By the way, Sean, the Clonus Film Festival is on this weekend. Are you coming up?
I won't be up in Monaghan this weekend, Pat. I can't help that one, unfortunately. But will we get details of it? Do you have a website offhand?
No, we'll get them to send them to you.
Yeah, get them to send us a little bit of detail, and we'll
thanks
give it a...
Thanks very much for your interest, Sean.
Not at all.
Make sure everybody in Monaghan comes to see this play.
Absolutely. Thanks, Pat, for being with us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Pat McCabe, Little White Lies, written and directed by Pat McCabe, and as he said himself, by Pat McCabe and a whole host of others, runs at the Garage Theatre in Monaghan on November the 7th, 8th and 9th. Now, we spoke to with Rosetta Cookie in recent times about this year's Wexford Festival Opera, which has as its theme theatre within theatre. On one of the main stage productions Rosetta told me about was Le Mascheri, the Italian composer Pietro Mascagni. His reputation was, of course, built on the success of Cavalleria Rusticana. So this is a lesser known work of his, and it is in many ways his homage to Rossini and Italian traditions of opera buffa and commedia dell'arte. Indeed, Le Mascheri references the masks of commedia dell'arte. Joined in studio this evening by Michael Dungan, who went to see the production, which opened at the Wexford Festival Opera on Friday evening. Before we get into this opera itself, we've been just talking during the ad break a bit about it there, Michael. Mascagni himself, very interesting where he comes in terms of Italian opera and the huge success he had very young.
Yeah, he was a nobody. His father was a baker. He just came out of nowhere and entered a competition run by Sonzono, the publishers. There were 72 entries. He came first. And like we were saying, just like an X Factor winner, it launched him, and the equivalent of the media machine went into top gear, and he was pestered and received love letters from all over, and people copying his the clothes he wore, and big star.
And that was on the basis of Cavalleria Rusticana.
Just on that.
A one-act opera.
Yeah.
Everybody, if you've even a passing interest in classical music, will know the famous intermezzo, the Kleenex ad of years ago. Everybody will know that piece of music.
Yeah.
And if you think of Cavalleria Rusticana, this is, you know, guy goes off to war, comes back home, and his girlfriend has run off with his best friend.
Yeah.
This is, you know, broken-hearted love stories.
Yeah, And it's gritty and it's verismo, you know, the new vogue in Italian opera, taken up then by Puccini as well.
Yeah, verismo, I suppose, would almost, if there is such a thing as realism in opera.
Yeah.
But that's what it was about. It was about ordinary people experiencing ordinary emotions.
Yeah, yeah.
In a truthful way, that was the plan.
Yeah, and then that's part of the problem with Le Masquerade is that he had so much success with that, but he had diverse talents and diverse interests, and he wanted to show the Italian public that he could write other kinds of opera as well.
Mad keen to write a tragedy.
A comedy, and it gets more complicated than that. He felt that the nationalism of Italian opera was slipping. I think partially to do with Verismo and its different principles. And he wanted to go back and reboot the nationalistic side of opera. And that's why one of the reasons why he looked back to Rossini.
Rossini. And the Commedia dell'arte, I suppose, would be important within that.
Because
essentially Commedia dell'arte would have been the theatre, the street theatre of the people.
Yeah.
A number of stock characters that people would just know them by their masks.
Yeah, that's it, yeah. Particularly Arlecchino,
Harlequin,
or Colombina, you know, the cheeky maid. The father in this one is Pantalone, as it always is.
Yeah.
You know, those kind of stock characters.
He can also be who's the character who's the older man who's always been
about
to be married off to the young.
Yes, the Capitano.
Yeah.
That's who we have here in this. So
we have these masks that the people put on. This opera then itself, it starts out and it's interrupted. But I was listening actually on the way home in the car on Friday evening. I was listening to the recording, was a live broadcast. It was going out on Lyric on Friday night, and they've barely stopped tuning and started the overture when it stopped.
Yes, man comes out on stage and interrupts the overture. And then has a row with the conductor, and we're laughing, you know.
Yeah. And there's a lot of laughing good,
it's going to be funny, but then it goes sober quite quickly, and we get a tutorial on masks and psychology, and it's not funny.
And is this down to the fault of the libretto, the original libretto?
I think it's a bit of both. I think there's some leeway when you translate into another language and when you update it. Like some of the terms that were used wouldn't have existed in the 19th century. And give you something to think about, but it also left you wondering, well, am I laughing or not here?
Because we're at an opera buffet.
Yeah,
we should be
exactly.
having a good time.
And meanwhile, while he's talking on the stage, the entire cast has lined the aisles. In absolutely stunning Commedia dell'arte costumes. And they are introduced one at a time. And then as he finishes, the last thing he says, which we don't, well, to me, it just kind of disappears at the end, is something about life's toughest dramas happen when we pretend we are something we are not. And think about that, and then that just didn't reappear.
Right, you didn't get that sense. Maybe perhaps that's a program note rather than a lecture on stage. However, then we get into the overture proper and the music itself.
Yeah,
you said this. It's an homage. Or you said to us that this is an homage to Rossini. Are we in the style of this very fast Rossini type music and patter type delivery?
Yes, it's more the spirit of Rossini, and it's for its day. It's modern. It's 1901, 11 years after Cavalleria Rusticana, and a good bit obviously after Rossini. So it would remind you of Rossini. Rather than mimic him.
Yeah.
And the humor starts. There's lots of antics. They strip off their costumes and put on modern clothes, and the setting has been updated to a posh wellness clinic.
That sounds like a fun idea.
It is. There's hamming and mugging, and a lot of it is a bit cringy.
And is this in terms of the acting or in terms of the music?
The direction, the way, you know, maybe it's meant to be over the top. But because of that, it kind of matches the unsettling feeling you had at the very beginning after we burst out laughing at the interruption.
Mm.
And then the lecture, the psychology lecture, it is a bit unsettling. It's hard to judge an audience, but they weren't rolling in the aisles for that.
In terms of the comic characters across the Commedia dell'arte stories are famously, you know, convoluted plots.
Yeah, yeah.
But people on the streets kind of knew who the character was just by looking at them. So they kind of had a rough idea what that character would do.
Yeah.
In terms of that particular aspect of it, there is one character within this who has this stutter aria the whole time. How is that handled and how is that portrayed?
Well, left intended to laugh at a speech impediment, which it was grating.
And again, is that within the original music?
Yeah, that's the aria is written with stammers in it. So it just, you know, it's a different age. It must have been okay to laugh then, but now it feels very uncomfortable. I'm a teacher. I can't laugh at somebody with a speech impediment. No, I don't think anybody can. And not many people did in Wexford.
Are there funny moments outside of that?
There are. I was going to mention the funniest person is the tenor, the Franco-Swiss tenor, who plays Arlecchino. He kind of stands out just with his physical movement and expression as being very, very funny. His name is Benoit Joseph Meyer. And there was something much more skilled and tight about the way he acted up. And it was very funny.
We have is he part of the duet that you suggest might be good to listen to?
No.
And what is within that duet then? The duet is Lavinia Beeny as Rosara and Andrew Marstein as Clorindo. This is in Act Two. This is Chi Romance.
Yes. Yeah. This is
Are these are the two lovers?
They are. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's have a listen to a little short extract then of the two of them as they sing together. Mm-hmm. And there we go, a little section from the Act Two duet from Les Masques, the Mascagni Opera, which is part of the Wexford Festival Opera. Lavinia Beeny as Rosara and Andrew Marstein as Clorindo in that performance there. Michael Dungan was at the performance for us on Friday evening. That is beautiful music, beautifully sung.
It is, yeah. And Lavinia Beeny was one of the standouts from the singers. She's an Italian soprano. And it's a great musical moment, and there are a couple of other moments like that, and the best music in it, the music that seized your attention, was music that was emotionally charged to do with love and heartbreak and so on.
Sounds like Cavalleria Rossa.
And unfortunately for Mascagni, yeah, it was music that reminded you of exactly the thing he was trying to get away from, which was Cavalleria Rusticana.
So he didn't quite manage the comedy Mascagni. And this is part of the thing Wexford do. They get these gems that have gone.
Yep.
But the challenge is you've got to show us why. Did you feel we didn't find out why?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it premiered in six Italian cities at the same time.
Years ago.
Yeah. Incredibly. And it simultaneously. And it flopped simultaneously in all six cities.
All six cities. Okay. Yeah. So... Any reason we should go to see it apart from that beautiful aria we just heard?
Yeah, there's another very good soprano, the Romanian Ioana Constantin Pipilea. And then there's amazing dancing choreographed by Stellario de Blasi in the Act Two big party scene. I'm not sure. To me, it wasn't obvious what it meant, but it was beautiful and mesmerising.
Beautiful to watch. Okay, that's Michael Dungan speaking to us about that production of Le Maschere, which is by Pietro Mascagni, of course, be performed as part of this year's Wexford Festival Opera, Wednesday and Saturday of this week, the 23rd and 26th, and on Thursday of next week, October the 31st, Halloween night. Full information and tickets on wexfordopera.ie. We asked you earlier on to identify a little piece of music. You don't have time to play it now, but I heard it 40 times today. I can't listen to it again. It was from Tetris, was what we were looking for. And Helen Harrington from Castle Baldwin in County Sligo will be heading off to the RTE Concert Orchestra on the 26th of October and getting the overnight stay to boot in the Wilder Hotel. That is our lot for this Monday evening, it is. And I've lost all my pages with people's names on them. So here we go. We'll give it a go. Paula Shields was the researcher this evening. Jamie Doyle was on sound. Oliver Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.